Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week, we began World War II, which is obviously a very significant period for geopolitics, because in a sense, when you have a war, you see geopolitics in action, as opposed to the speculation of commentators on geopolitics. And I ought to mention at this point that Graham and I are recording this on the evening of the 18th. And obviously, although we're talking about World War II, and we do intend towards the end of the series to get right up to the present day. So it's not as though we're not aware that there might, to some listeners, seem somewhat strange that we're not focusing on Ukraine and Gaza. But anyway, World War II. We started in the early stages of World War II last time, and I made the point that it was really December 41 in which, with America's entry into the war, geopolitically, the parameters changed. And I want to pick up from that point. And I want to start off by saying that when Hitler declared war on America, which is on the 11th of December, 41, this moved the half war between the two countries of limits and nuance to full-scale conflict. Now, we've already discussed that Hitler's tried to rationalize the irrational, and in a way, geopolitics as a rhetoric can be regarded as a rationalization of the irrational. And as I've been trying to argue throughout these talks, geopolitics has a range of meanings which overlap from whatever you might mean by objective analysis, however described, to what you might well call the rhetoric of power, and that the two are not necessarily as disparate as one might imagine, because an objective geopolitical stance is much harder to envisage and execute than you might imagine. Now, for Americans, Pearl Harbor was also a matter of perception. You know, Hitler wasn't alone in that, the day of infamy and of assessment. The attack demonstrated a surprising Japanese ability to overcome the constraints of space, of distance. In addition, there was a geographical divide in that Americans on the Pacific coast feared imminent Japanese action. And there's a wonderful novelistic approach to that in James Ellroy's novel Perfidy. You may or may not dislike the novel or like the novel, but he certainly captures in novel form the sense in Los Angeles and the environs that Japanese submarines were there and that attack might well be imminent. And that fear was scarcely the case on the Atlantic. And this underlines the extent to which geopolitics is as much a matter of perception, as indeed is the term such as strategic culture, as any undergirding reality. After all, why should one particularly take the perception of the East Coast more than the perception of the West Coast, or vice versa? And there is therefore a related cartography of concern, a matter not only of external features such as coastlines, but also of the domestic differences. So on the West Coast, there was a hostile policy adopted to Japanese Americans, whereas there was not judged to be the same need for internment and movement seen with German and Italian counterparts further east. For all powers, although least for the Soviet Union, geopolitical assumptions during the war were to a degree questioned by the use of air power. After all, the attack on Pearl Harbor had been an attack in which a relatively modest outlay of aircraft appeared to have made an absolutely fundamental difference to the naval balance of power in the Pacific. And air power, in place of pre-war speculations about what it might entail, now posed new challenges for understanding opportunities and threats and for presenting distance, routes, and links. And these opportunities and threats were in the here and now. And again, I mean, obviously, there are comparisons to the discussion of geopolitics in the present day, whether one's talking about Taiwan, Ukraine, Iran, Gaza, or any one of 101 places. It's interesting that if you look at the early 40s, globes were used and indeed referred to by some leaders, notably Roosevelt, in his radio talks, weekly radio talks. Globes provided a clear guide to the locations of the simultaneity of conflict in the world, although not to the time-space equations necessarily involved in moving forces between them. Globes also offered more than conventional accounts, although it was not easy in a globe or in any other form to address the three-dimensional nature of air power and, as a related point, the three-dimensional obligations of anti-aircraft weaponry and doctrine. Churchill also had a well-stocked map room with officers charged with updating them. He liked to travel with his maps, and Hitler liked to be photographed, pictured with maps. Indeed, his looking at a map helped to save him at the time of the July bomb plot. There were very different levels of skill in the handling of the time-space equations that arose from this use of cartography, this use of distance. And I would like to suggest that both Roosevelt and Churchill proved more perceptive than Hitler, which is not really surprising given their background. But certainly, it was necessary to understand the strategic weight and interactions of particular issues and areas. In terms of individual quality, continuity was clearly at play in World War II geopolitics, with many who were prominent having also been so during World War I, notably Churchill, of course, who began both conflicts as First Lord of the Admiralty, which means operational head of the largest navy in the world. He'd been in Parliament at the same time as Mackinder, and in 1919-21 was Secretary of State for War and Air at the same time that Mackinder was a key figure in British policy in South Russia and at least once reported to the cabinet. Roosevelt himself had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy, the American Navy, from 1913 to 1920, at that point the second largest navy in the world, and had great interests in the works of Alfred Thayer Mahan, the American writer on naval power and naval geopolitics. Now, the public, alongside the state obligations to try and understand distance, prioritization, and what they entailed, the public requirements for propaganda and public education were apparent, but they were addressed more effectively by some commentators than others. So as we already mentioned last time, Harrison, with his aerial perspective maps, was able to provide a cartography vivid for the American public, but which drew on what air power could do. And he actually also tried to engage the public. So I noticed the following map by him, The World Divided, published in Fortune in July 1941, carrying a note explaining the North Polar equidistant projection used in the map. And he wrote as followed, trying to make it comprehensible. The world centrifuge, the principle of this projection may be illustrated by a dancer with a skirt in the shape of a globe upon which is inscribed the map of the world. When she whirls, the skirt rises to a horizontal plane, and the map on it will then resemble the map on this page. The projection has two important advantages. It shows little distortion of the northern hemisphere, and it nowhere breaks the continuity of the lands or seas involved in the present far-flung struggle. In other words, what Harrison is doing is he is trying to explain to the audience why a particular projection is used. It's a kind of engaged democratic means of cartographic elucidation. There is no equivalent for axis mapping. Again, F.E. Manning of the Chicago Sun, in his October 43 Target Berlin and Target Tokyo maps, which were in fact printed and distributed by the American Army, positioned the targets at the center of the map and included the explanation. This map is a photographic view of the world with the center at Berlin. Thus, with the detachable scale, distances can be measured along any line running through Berlin. Manning's maps worked not only as accounts of aerial warfare, but also of ways to explain the converging goal and character of Allied strategy as a whole, one geopolitics converging on Berlin, one on Tokyo. The idea of a target was also used by Edwin Sundberg in the New York Sunday News of September the 3rd, 1944, with the map organized in terms of bombing distances to Tokyo marked at 300-mile intervals. Indeed, air power challenged the traditional geopolitical dichotomy of land and sea. Writers such as Carl Schmitt, in his Land and Sea, published in the United States in 1942, argued that this capability of air power would revolutionize geopolitics. Air power was certainly a particularly grave threat to naval forces, both surface and submarine. So in early 42, Admiral Sir Geoffrey Leighton, who was a British commander in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, noted in his war diary that in the face of Japanese advance, quote, the problem of retaining control of the coastal waters of Burma, Myanmar, was quite beyond our powers in the absence of either air superiority or fast patrol craft with good AA, that's anti-aircraft, armament so numerous that we could afford substantial losses. In contrast to the maps we've been referring to, whether by Harrison or Manning or Sundberg, the Mercator projection was unhelpful in the depiction of air routes. Great circle routes and distances, both of which were important for air power, were poorly presented because distances in the northern and southern latitudes were exaggerated. And indeed, the Mercator projection was criticized in print in the United States, again, nothing comparable in Germany, including in Life, the New York Times, and the Saturday Review of Literature, as distorting the world, and in particular, as exaggerating America's isolation from Europe. In other words, alongside what we might see as the objective point about the deficiencies of the Mercator projection, there is also a rhetorical point of trying to persuade the public that they are centrally concerned with what is happening in Europe because it is closer to America than they might otherwise imagine. At the same time, maps could be flawed as guides to strategy and for physical as well as political reasons. I've already mentioned the problems with Harrison's map about Japan from Alaska, which was not really, he produced a map. It went out for for the American Armed Forces on the 8th of May, 1944. And what he ignored were the difficulties of building up supplies in Alaska, and the extent to which the Alaska-Hokkaido route, Hokkaido is the northernmost main island of Japan, the Japanese home islands, was not viable unless the Soviet Union cooperated. But it wasn't going to do that because it had a non-aggression treaty with Japan. So also with Harrison's map, the so-called, this was the title he gave it, the Not-So-Soft Underside, published in Fortune on January the 27th, 1943, as Anglo-American forces prepared to battle German-Italian opponents in Tunisia, which they were successfully to do, and rapidly so, in a campaign in which the Axis forces lost as heavily as they had recently done at Stalingrad. And it's interesting to note that people always play up the losses of the Wehrmacht and its allies at the hands of the Soviet Union and are apt to underplay losses at the hands of the British and Americans. And again, I think one can draw attention to the politicized nature of Cold War treatments of World War II and the extent to which, as a result, particularly of left-wing pressures in the academic world, those views still continue. Anyway, Harrison offered an apparent reading from the topography, and the topography itself, in other words, the terrain, okay, was emphasized thanks to a vertical scale that was out of proportion to that on the ground. In other words, the height of mountain ranges was exaggerated in the map, visually they were presented in the map, and very disproportionate to the horizontal scale. He wrote as follows. No full-fledged military expedition since ancient times has succeeded in crossing the Pyrenees or the Alps from south to north and making the invasion stick. The great formative invasions since the time of the Romans have all come from east to west, from the Russian plains or the Anatolian plateau of Turkey. The soft underside of the axis, the underprotected belly of Europe, he's using quotation marks there, is then a figure of speech that lacks geographical common sense. The mountains and sketchy roads of crippled Spain, the narrow, easily closed gap of the Rhone, the tunnels of Switzerland, the Nazi air force in Crete pose terrifying problems of both military tactics and supply. From the communications officer's view, it is thus American dollars to Italian lira that Hitler's Germany will not be invaded in force from North Africa. He goes on. What did we get out of the African campaign? When the Mediterranean is cleared, it will save miles of shipping. But from the positive standpoint, it spreads Hitler thin all around the margins of Europe. He must defend Italy to keep Americans from taking over airfields within striking distance of the Skoda Works in Pilsen and Munich. Possession of the Mediterranean's south shore gives the United Nations the opportunity to deliver confusing multiple blows, and Hitler's own power of the initiative has been critically impaired. In other words, for Harrison, it's very obvious. You mustn't, it's good to be in the Mediterranean, but you mustn't then try and move north. Fair enough. And you could argue that the very grave difficulties of the Italian campaign, and I noticed James Holland, I've read it, has just brought out an excellent book on the 1943 section of the campaign in Italy, is one which shouldn't have been pursued, you know, and that's a point of view. And it's as it were, in Harrison's viewpoint, geography dictates what is a sensible choice. But as we know, the Allied invasion of Italy indeed rapidly followed, and the consequences of this invasion could be seen in contrasting ways. The slow pace of the advance up Italy definitely indicated that Harrison was correct at the operational level, with the mountainous terrain and steep river valleys making movement and attack difficult. But in 1943, it's hard to see how the invasion of first Sicily and then mainland Italy was not an option. Doing so had the benefits of increasing Allied options for maritime usage, taking specific advantage of amphibious capability. It had the advantage of building up the relevant experience of large-scale amphibious operations. You really didn't want the first one to be the invasion of Normandy. You wanted to be able to practice. It demonstrated to the Soviet Union that the Western Allies were in land combat, very necessarily so, because the Soviet Union had been bitterly complaining and there had been talk that they might negotiate with the Axis. It weakened the Axis alliance. Well, it definitely did. It led to Italy being knocked in the war. And it increased pressure on Germany, not least by lessening its strategic reserve. In the absence of this offensive, the Allied offensive, it's unclear that forces would have been used elsewhere in the Mediterranean with more success, and more divisions would not have strengthened the Normandy operation in 44, but would simply have increased the logistical burden. There's only so many divisions that you could land across the Normandy beaches and then supply there. And indeed, Normandy had the great disadvantage of being an extraordinarily congested battlefield, which did, in fact, give advantages to the German defenders, because there was a limited number of lines of advance for the British, the Americans, and the Canadians. So what is interesting is that Harrison makes a very clear prediction, if you like, a geopolitical geography dictates this, but in practical terms, it doesn't engage at the strategic level. And more generally, this was very much seen with the competing agendas adopted by services, individual services, you know, ASC land and commanders, agendas for alliances as a whole, for particular states, for individual military components, and the competition between intelligence agencies. All of them offered, at some stage or other, geopolitical arguments. But what a surprise, those arguments demonstrated the apparent necessity of the option they wished to pursue. And that really ought to lead us to beg some questions about the use of geopolitical argument. Indeed, I would suggest that geopolitical discussion and imagery sought to offer a fixity to strategy, it must be A, which is the usual pattern that's used today. But in wartime, this fixity was shown to be vulnerable to circumstances, to the uncertainty of war, and to fear, as the problems and results of campaigning led to pressures for changes in direction and intensity. You know, you can see that in all sorts of wars. You can see it with Union axes of advance in the American Civil War. You can see it in the war in World War II as German resistance hardened in 44 and 45. So, you know, in that sense, the geopolitics doesn't change. There is still the same number of miles from the Normandy beaches to Essen and from Essen to Berlin. But the problem is that resistance hardens. Resistance is much stronger by November 44, even more December 44, than it had been in late August 44. And yet the geography hasn't changed. Incidentally, the despair among British and American policymakers in the war of 44-45 encouraged a marked escalation of the Allied air offensive on Germany. And again, that's another matter. You can talk about the geopolitics of the air offensive. You know, we've got air bases in eastern England. They can be used by the Americans and the British. They can bomb Germany. But the actual intensity of that air offensive is not directed by any such sense of geopolitical considerations. World War II, it's worth bearing in mind, also saw initiatives that are rather interesting in their reaction to geographical apparent constraints. A classic example of that was American policy in the Pacific. The Americans wanted to gain Pacific islands from which Japan could be bombed, a strong commitment to the idea of ground-based air power, understandably so, because ground-based aircraft can carry far greater tonnage than you can get from an air force operating from a number of carriers. But what the Americans did was, instead of trying to, as it were, advance as a line, as it were, across the Pacific, they went in for leapfrogging, in which they neutralized Pacific island bases such as Rabaul or Truk, which were major bases, Japanese bases. They tried to degrade them by air attack, but they also designed a response, if you like, to the geographical space of the Pacific and the way in which the Japanese put up a formidable defense by essentially lessening the number of targets. Now, that is a classic example of a military usage of a different level, and there are strategic, operational, and tactical levels for all of this, which isn't dictated to by geography. It's, in a way, you could argue, a way to confront the geography, but it's not dictated to by it. And it's worth also bearing in mind that if you're looking at that in particular, the Americans combined tools that were in their inventory, including amphibious doctrine, carrier operations, landing craft, long-range aircraft, mobile airfield construction, and fleet supply trains. Now, all of these required, as it were, doctrine, resources, training, and skill. They weren't in some way an inevitable product of the circumstances being faced. And it's worth bearing in mind that there is, as part of this variant, the technological determination, but the technology itself is not one that it can be very important. And ultimately, of course, with the atomic bomb, it plays a key role. And incidentally, it may... I'm surprised that people haven't commented, just going to the present day. I noticed that President Putin is able to get away with threatening to use nuclear bombs. I noticed the Israelis showing much more restraint, have not drawn people's attention to the fact that if threatened with Armageddon and genocide, they do actually have nuclear armaments of their own. And one would like to feel that they would not be pressed so hard by genocidal forces that they were felt perforce obliged to use them. Anyway, going back to 1944, J.F.C. Fuller wrote in the Sunday Pictorial, that's a British newspaper, and it exemplifies the way in which the Allies were offering, not the Soviets, of course, informed views to the public. I mean, Fuller, if you look at Fuller's papers, which in this respect, they're scattered, but in this respect, they're in Rutgers, a university library in the United States. They mark up in them some of, I mean, Fuller marked up in them some of his articles that were censored. And what was censored? He was a very bitter critic of Churchill during the war. Anyway, Fuller wrote on the 1st of October 44, "Had our sea power remained what it had been, solely a weapon to command the sea, the garrison Germany established in France almost certainly would have proved sufficient. It was a change in the conception of naval power which sealed the doom of that great fortress. Now ships were fitted to the invading forces." What he meant is that it was now possible to land a large force on open beaches, whereas prior to that, large forces had required harbours, and what you had to do is secure the harbours, places like Cherbourg and Le Havre, as fortresses, which the Germans, of course, did, and that that would thwart an invasion. And what he was arguing is that the geography, the geographical dimension of German control of France had been totally altered by the nature of a technological change. You can see the same thing from a different direction. If you're looking at the British projected invasion of Malaya and Singapore, Operation Zipper, now this was regarded by British commentators as very important to British prestige in order to repair the repeated humiliating failures of imperial collapse in 41-42. So going back to Leighton and his papers, I read his papers in the manuscript room of the British Library. In September 44, Leighton, still in command in Ceylon, wrote of, quote, "the vital importance of our recapturing those parts of the empire as far as possible ourselves. I would specially mention the recapture of Burma and its culmination in the recovery of Singapore by force of arms and not by waiting for it to be surrendered as part of any peace treaty. The immense effect this will have on our prestige in the Far East in post-war years. This, and only this, in my opinion, will restore us to our former level in the eyes of the native population in these parts." And in that correspondence, particular volume is 74796, you can see Mountbatten writing to Leighton and agreeing with him. The first letter was from Leighton to the First Sea Lord. Mountbatten, who's copied in, writes to Leighton and agrees. In other words, geopolitics here is subordinated to issues of prestige. Now, we don't have to agree with Leighton. He had a standard racist assumption about what he called native peoples and the value of the impression of success in maintaining imperial sway and power. But what he captured is that realist criteria of strength, such as troop numbers, are not enough. There are issues of morale and impression that are very significant. And again, if you're looking at the current conflicts in the world, those clearly are playing a role. Quite clearly, forces are pushing themselves forward by violence in order to, as it were, try and dictate that they should be considered, and they're quite willing to be extraordinarily brutal to that end. Throughout the war, World War II, the allocation of effort was important. It was a choice. It wasn't inevitable. The Allies in particular, but also the Germans in late 44, would Hitler move troops from the Eastern Front to attack the Allies, as he did in the Battle of the Bulge, or would he maintain most of his forces on the Eastern Front to protect Berlin from advancing Soviet forces? There was a political strategy which explains why he hoped to knock Britain and America so hard that they would leave the war, which took precedence over issues whether you might regard them as simply operational military issues or those encoded on some kind of geopolitical measure, whether it's a map or whatever. And the same thing for Britain. For the Soviet Union, of course, part of this geopolitics was the movement of war manufacturing eastwards. For the United States, there was the establishment of new plant, including shipyards and aircraft manufacturing, notably on the West Coast. There was, as I mentioned last time, the geopolitics of global supply links. So the supply side reflects both geopolitics, however construed, but also the political nature of that society, whether, as it were, the constraints of space and opportunity have a capitalist interpretation, which is in part the United States' cooperation with a corporatist system, or not. And obviously the Soviet Union moves in a very different way. So if I might just close my World War II section, I think it's worth saying that in 1945, with the use of atomic bombs against Japan, these, in a sense, I mean, you know, and obviously it's very controversial and goes without saying, but these, in a sense, did overcome distance. The Japanese, at the time of the dropping of the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, were in control of a very formidable part of China, including Beijing, Nanjing, Shanghai, Guangzhou. They were in charge of Korea. They were in charge of Vietnam, Malaya, Singapore, Sumatra, Java, a significant part of Borneo. They were in charge of Taiwan. They were in charge of more territory than they had been on the day they bombed Pearl Harbor. And that, in a sense, the bombing of Japan through the atomic ordnance not only helped to obviate the need for a highly costly invasion of Japan, but it also overcame the space-time force constraints and paradigms that would have been involved if there'd been a large-scale operation over a period of years to try and drive the Japanese out of the empire they'd conquered. So, geopolitics, yes, very important. Does it deserve the attention given it to it today as if it's a sort of hidden hand of war and international relations? No. Like everything else, look at my book on technology and war, it should be seen as part of a multifaceted series of interactive relationships and contexts, and not as a determining force.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy, for all that. I want to start by picking up a very interesting point you made about the role of air power in strategic and geopolitical considerations. So, for example, in order to strike Japan better, Americans fight very difficult battles to take over Pacific islands in order to establish air bridgeheads from which to attack Japan. Similarly, the aspect in which the invasion of Italy was motivated by many strategic considerations, but in part the ability to seize Italian air bases and use them for strategic bombing of Germany. So we have this situation whereby technology, which appears to be able to leapfrog across geography through the air, actually ultimately means you've got to start seizing bits of geography, be it Italy or Pacific Islands and so on. To what extent did that then become self-fulfilling in the sense of, well, if you're going to take South Italy to have, the airfield at Barry or wherever, you then got to push the Axis further back in order to prevent them counterattacking and so on. And then you end up taking more islands than you perhaps need.
Yes, well, I think you're absolutely right. Different territories take on particular significance. So, if you're looking at Pacific Islands, you're looking at those islands where you can actually produce a long runway and where you're going to be able to land supplies, crucially aviation fuel and ordnance. And some islands that's true of, and others it's not true of. And as you know, the government, I mean, probably the most dramatic example of the influence is that the Tojo government in Japan fell after the Americans captured the island of Saipan, from which they could mount bombing raids on the Japanese home islands. And that in the summer of 44. I mean, it's very interesting. Japan and Germany goes in different directions politically in the summer of 44. The Tojo government falls, but in Germany, Hitler survives the bomb plot and, in fact, increases his control, notably over the armed forces. No, you're right. Individual pieces of territory become important because of the way that you can use them. But it's worth bearing in mind that territory can also be a waste of time. I mean, I've mentioned Rabaul and Truk. Well, I've been to Rabaul, I've not been to Truk. Rabaul's in the Bismarck Archipelago of just off New Guinea. And I went there, I think, about 4 years ago, and there was an enormous Japanese base there, an enormous air base there, large numbers of troops, all a complete waste of time. Because, I mean, it was neutralized by bombing attacks, and the Americans then bypassed it, and the garrison sort of rotted. You could argue the same thing is true of Hitler's Festung or fortress policy. He set up these Festung, and what he ended up doing was putting units in fortified cities, which, if the Allies had any sense, interesting question here, because of the obviously the situation in Gaza is very different because it can be used to fire missiles. But if we're looking at the context of 43, 44, 45, rather than trying to actually fight your way in and capture them, you're better off masking them and just leaving the Germans in there to rot. And you're thinking of places, some of which it was felt necessary to take because you want to be able to reopen the harbour. Cherbourg is an example. But some of the Breton and Channel Coast positions, some of the positions on the Eastern Front, well, what the hell is the point of tying up troops in there? So a lot of positions can, in a sense, be regarded as consequential and not be consequential. You devote an enormous amount of energy to fortifying them, and then they're not used.
A very interesting quote that you provided about the sense that the British shouldn't wait for the Japanese to cede away their gains in negotiation. They needed to, they being the British, they needed to go to fight the way through to push the Japanese out if the British wanted to be taken seriously amongst the Asian inhabitants as a consequence. I'm wondering, just looking from the other perspective, what the Japanese geopolitical angle was. I mean, there are clear strategic imperatives for the Japanese pushing down through Malaya towards the Malacca and Singapore Straits. They're gaining important war resources, rubber, oil, and so on, in doing so. But what really are the limits of what they felt they needed to do for their own war machine, as distinct from having a wider ambition? So, did they really need to go into Burma, or did they go into Burma because if they were going to ultimately invade India, they had to do it through Burma and say it was a stepping stone? But it involved enormous strategic reach and ultimately overreach for them to do these things.
Well, that again is a fascinating question. I mean, I think the key thing with Burma is, as it were, it was an aspect of Japan's China problem. How are you going to get China out of the war? How are you going to force the Chinese to negotiate. And cutting off China seemed to be the obvious way to do it. So I think one should see the Japanese in Burma not as an approach to India, but as a means against Burma. From that point of view, at a relatively modest outgoing in 42, they had kicked the British out quite easily. What they then didn't do, and I think quite sensibly in 42 or 43, is try and press against the British in Northeast India, and they defended themselves in the Arakan campaign quite successfully. They resumed the offensive in 44, the Impala Kohima one. Now, you could argue that that might well have been a mistake, but they saw that as a way of forward defence, of disrupting the likely British offensive into Burma.
Right, very, very interesting. Well, there's so much more we could discuss, but I'm afraid we're almost out of time. This has been a really interesting way of looking at the Second World War. And Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Yes, I mean, it is interesting. And what I want to do is to make it clear to listeners, there's not any one way that you should do it. And that's the point. That the mistake is to assume this is the answer. And I find it truly depressing to see the number of books published in which you're told this is the definitive account or this is the account you have to read. I mean, this is deeply confused and misleading as a way to approach World War II. And I've tried in my book on strategy in World War II to emphasize the plasticity, the way in which you have to hold into your head the number of different strategies and therefore geopolitics on offer. And I think that's a very significant one. Some of these maps, by the way, can be seen in my book on 100 maps of World War II, particularly the Harrison ones, which I think are really interesting, both for what they show us about the war and also for what they show us about mapping. Anyway, next time we're going to press on into the post-war world. We're going to start with the geopolitics of the early stages of the Cold War. But as I've said, we are going to come up to the present day. I don't want people to feel that this is an exercise in ignoring the world that is occurring around us.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much again.
Thank you.